From Furious Seasons and Other Stories. For Marianne again, and for Kurt Johnson and Max Crawford, Dick Day, Bill Kitteridge, Chuck Kinder, and Diane Cecily, creditors. We're none of us the same. We're moving on. The story continues, but we're no longer the main characters. James Salter, Light Years. Pastoral. When he came out of the cafe, it had stopped snowing, and the sky was clearing over behind the hills on the other side of the river. He stopped beside the car for a minute and stretched, holding the door half open, yawning a big mouthful of cold air. He'd swear he could almost taste it. He eased in behind the steering wheel and got back on the highway. It was only about an hour's drive from here, and he would still have a couple of good hours this afternoon. Then there was tomorrow, all day tomorrow. Just thinking about it was something. At Park Junction, he crossed the river and turned off the highway up the road to the lodge. The furry, snow-heavy trees came right up beside the road. Clouds mantled the steep white hills that started up on either side so that it was hard to tell where the hills ended and the sky began. A little like some of those Chinese landscapes they'd looked at that time in Portland. He liked them. Something different. Said as much to Frances, but of course she wasn't sure. It was a shame she hadn't decided to come along. Thinking about it, he edged a little in the seat, stroked his chin. It was going on noon when he got there. He saw the cabins, first up on the hill and then, as the road straightened out, the lodge itself. He slowed, bumped off the road onto the dirty, sand-covered parking lot, and stopped up close to the front door. He rolled down the window and rested for a minute, working his shoulders back and forth into the seat. He closed his eyes, then opened them. A pale red, flickering neon sign said, Castle Rock, and below that a neat, hand-painted sign, Deluxe Cabins, Office. The last time he'd been here, Frances and he, 3 years ago that fall, they'd stayed for 3 days, and he'd landed 5 nice fish in the hole downriver. They used to come often, 2 or 3 times a year. He opened the door and got out slowly, feeling the stiffness in his back and neck. He walked heavily across the bright frozen snow and stuck his hands in his coat pockets as he started up the planked stairs. At the top, he scraped the snow and grit off his shoes and nodded to a young couple coming out. He noticed the way the man held her arm as they went down the stairs. He zipped up his coat and pulled it down as far as he could over his pants before opening the door. It seemed dark inside, and there was a smell of wood smoke and fried ham, somewhere a clatter of dishes. He leaned against the door and let his eyes adjust to the light. They had made some changes. Down the wall on his right, the counter and the little tables, they were there before, but not the postcard rack and the colored gumball machine beside the door. He reached out and laid his hand over the glass top, blotting out the Lions Club sticker. On his left was a glass case with leather purses and high-heeled shoes inside, leather wallets and pairs of moccasins. Scattered around on top, Indian bead necklaces and bracelets, pieces of petrified wood. He remembered a fireplace from before, but they must have covered it up or something. He pushed away from the door, past all of the stuff without looking again, over to the counter. He climbed onto the stool the way somebody might climb onto a horse, swinging his leg over and settling down until his cheeks hung over the sides. He never thought about how it might look until after he'd done it. Carefully, he looked around. 2 men sitting a few stools down had stopped talking to look at him. There were hunters, red hats and coats lying on an empty table behind them. He waited, pulling at his fingers, sliding the gold wedding ring up to his knuckle and back again, noticing how loose it was. How long you been here? The girl asked, frowning. She'd come on him soundlessly from the kitchen.
Not long.
You should have rung the bell. I didn't even know you were here.
Silver braces, upper and lower, glittered as she opened and closed at him. I'm supposed to have a cabin. I wrote you a card last week or so.
I'll have to get Mrs. May. She's cooking. She's the one looks after the cabins.
She took a step toward the kitchen.
I don't know. She didn't say anything. We don't usually keep them open in the winter, you know.
But I wrote you a card. He creaked the stool around, facing her. The two men turned on their stools to look at him again.
I'll get Mrs. May, she said.
Flushed, he rubbed his hands together. A big Frederick Remington reproduction hung over the counter, and he watched the lurching, frightened buffalo and the Indians with the drawn bows fixed at their shoulders.
Mr. Harold, the old lady called, coming toward him.
A short, gray-haired woman with heavy breasts and a fat throat, underwear showing through beneath her white uniform. She undid her apron and held out a white, water-drawn hand.
Glad to see you, Mrs. May.
My, I hardly recognized you, Mr. Harold. I don't know what's the matter with the girls sometimes.
Edith.
She's my granddaughter. My daughter and her husband are looking after the place now.
She took off her glasses and began wiping away the steam, smiling. He looked down at the polished counter, smoothed his fingers over the cool, grainy wood.
Where's the missus?
Didn't feel too well this week. I don't know.
He shifted his weight to the other leg and raised his eyes to her chin.
Now, I'm sorry to hear that. I had the place fixed up nice for the two of you. It might have done her good to get out. It's funny how much better you feel sometimes just getting out.
She laid the apron behind the cash register.
Edith? I'm taking Mr. Harold to his cabin. I'll have to get my coat, Mr. Harold.
There was no answer, but the girl came to the kitchen door and watched them leave. Outside, the sun had come out, and the glare hurt his eyes. He held on to the banister and went slowly down the stairs, following.
Sun's bad, isn't it? The first time it's been out all week, though.
She waved at some people going by in a car. They went past a gasoline pump, locked and covered with snow, and past a little shed with a tires sign hung over the door. He looked through the broken windows at the heaps of burlap sacks, the old tires, and the barrels. The room was damp and cold-looking with the snow drifted inside and sprinkled on the sill around the broken glass.
Kids have done that, she said, stopping for a minute and putting her hand up to the broken window. They don't miss a chance to do us dirt. A whole pack of them all the time running wild from down at the construction camp.
She shook her head. Poor little devils.
Sorry home life for kids anyway. Always on the move like that. Their daddies are building on that dam.
She unlocked the cabin door and pushed on it.
I made a fire this morning, so it would be nice for you.
I appreciate that, Mrs. May.
There was a big double bed covered with a plain bedspread, a bureau, and a writing desk in the front room, which was divided from the kitchen by a waist-high wood partition. A sink, wood stove, wood box, an old ice box, an oilcloth-covered table, and two wooden chairs. The other two doors opened to the toilet and to a little porch where there was a place he could hang his clothes.
Looks fine, he said.
I tried to fix it up a little. Do you need anything, Mr. Harold?
Not now, anyway, but I'll see when I come down.
I'll let you go, then. You're probably tired driving all that way.
I guess I should bring up my things.
He shut the door behind them, and they stood on the porch, looking down the hill. He fingered a cigarette out, licked the end before putting it in his mouth.
I'm just sorry the missus couldn't come, she said. Doesn't seem right.
From where they stood, they were almost on a level with the huge, snowy black rock protruding from the hillside behind the road. Some people said it looked like a castle. He took the cigarette out of his mouth as she started to move away.
How's the fishing?
Some of them are getting them, but most of the boys are out hunting. Deer season, you know.
He drove the car up as far as he could and started to unload. The last thing he took out of the car was a pint of scotch from the glove compartment. He set the bottle on the table, and later, as he spread out the boxes of weights and the silver hooks and thick-bodied red and white flies, he moved it to the drain board. Sitting there at the table smoking a cigarette with his tackle box open and everything in place, his flies and the weights spread out, testing leader strength between his hands and tying up outfits for that afternoon, he was glad he'd come. And he still had a couple of good hours left this afternoon. Then tomorrow. He'd already decided he would save the bottle for when he came back tonight, and the rest for tomorrow. Once he thought he heard a scratching at the door and got up from the table to look, but there was nothing. Only the steep, shiny white hills and dead-looking pines under the overcast sky, and down below the few buildings and cars drawn up beside the highway. He still had plenty of time. Why not stretch out for a few minutes? It would be better just before dark anyway. He could go down in an hour or so. He shut the door and checked the stove before he began to undress. Then, in his shorts, padding on the cold floor, he cleaned off the table and got in between the cold sheets, trembling. For a while, he lay on his side, eyes closed, knees drawn up for warmth, then turned onto his back and wiggled his toes against the sheet. He wished Francis were here, somebody to talk to. He opened his eyes. The room was dark. The stove gave off little crackling noises, and there was a red glow shadowing on the wall behind it. He lay there trying to focus his eyes on the window, not able to believe it was really dark outside. He shut his eyes again and turned over, stretching his legs slowly. He'd only wanted to sleep, maybe an hour. He opened his eyes and sat up heavily on the side of the bed. He got on his shirt and reached for his pants. The floor was still cold. He went into the bathroom and pissed, then washed his hands and face with cold water. He walked back into the kitchen, turning his head back and forth, trying to get rid of the thick, dull feeling. "God damn it," he said, banging things around in the cupboard and taking down some cans and putting them back again. He heated up a pot of coffee and drank two cups before deciding to go down to the cafe for something solid. He put on wool slippers and a coat, hunted around until he found his flashlight, and went out. The cold air stung his cheeks and pinched his nostrils together, but it felt good. The trail was slippery, but the lights from the cafe showed him where he was walking, and he was careful. He nodded to the girl Edith and sat down in a booth near the end of the counter. The cafe was empty now, and he could hear a radio playing back in the kitchen.
"Are you closed?"
"Kind of. I'm cleaning up for in the morning."
"Too late for something to eat, then."
"I guess I can get you something."
She came over with the menu and a glass of water.
"Mrs. May around, Edith?"
"She's up in her room. Did you want something?"
"I need more wood. For in the morning."
"That's out in back."
He pointed on the menu to a ham sandwich with potato salad.
"I guess I'll have this."
Waiting, he began moving the salt and pepper shakers around in a little circle in front of him. He should have just gotten a milkshake and a sandwich to take back to the cabin. After she brought the plate over, she hung around in front, filling sugar bowls and napkin holders, looking up at him sometimes. The bitch. She came over then with a wet rag and began wiping the crumbs off the table in front of him. He sat with his hands folded across his stomach, looking down at the rag sliding back and forth across the table, leaving the little streaks. He left money and went out through a door on the side, around to the back where he picked up an armload of the frozen blocks. Then the snail's pace up to the cabin. He looked back once and saw her watching him from the kitchen window. By the time he got to his door and dropped the wood, he hated her. He lay on the bed for a long time and read Life magazines that Mrs. May had left. When he felt sleepy, he got up and cleared off his bed and the table and arranged his things for in the morning in a corner. He looked through the pile of stuff again to make sure he had everything. He liked things in order and didn't want to get up in the morning and have to look all over for something. He picked up the bottle, held it up to the light, and poured some into a cup. He carried it over to the bed and set it on the nightstand. He turned off the light and stood beside the window for a minute, scratching himself before getting into bed. He still had tomorrow. Or was it today? He got up so early it was still almost dark in the cabin. The stove had gone down to coals during the night, and he could see his breath. He adjusted the grate and pushed in some blocks. He fixed three peanut butter sandwiches, wrapped them in wax paper, and slipped these and some cookies into a coat pocket. He couldn't remember the last time he'd gotten up so early.
For breakfast, he drank almost a quart of chocolate milk, standing at the drain board in his wool stocking feet. At the door, he pulled on his waders. Outside, it was that vague gray half-light just before full morning. Clouds lay fastened to the tops of the mountains and filled the long valleys and hung in patches over the trees. Down the hill, the lodge was dark, and there were no cars, only the pickup with the advertising printed on the side. He moved out slowly down the packed, slippery trail toward the river. Likely there was no one up at this hour, and it pleased him. Somewhere in one of the valleys off behind the river, he heard the pop-pop of shots and counted them. 7, 8. The hunters were awake. And the deer. He wondered if the shots came from the two hunters he'd seen in the lodge yesterday. Deer didn't have much of a chance in snow like this. He kept his eyes down, watching the trail. It kept dropping downhill, and soon he was in heavy timber, snow up to his ankles. Under the trees, the snow lay drifted around grotesque, frozen bushes, but wasn't too deep where he walked. It was thick with pine needles that crunched into the snow under his boots. He could still see his breath fogging out in front of him. He held the heavy rod straight ahead of him when he had to push through the bushes or go under the trees with low limbs. He held it under his arm like it was a lance, and sometimes, when he was a kid and had gone fishing for 2 or 3 days at a time, hiking in by himself, he'd carried his rod like this even when there was no brush or trees, maybe just a big green meadow, and he'd imagine himself in the lists coming down on his opponent. The jays at the crowded edge of the woods screaming for him. Then when it was over, he would sing something as loud as he could, yell defiance until his chest hurt at the hawks that circled and circled over the meadow. The sun and the lace sky and the back lake with the lean-to. The water was clear and green. You could see 15, 20 feet down to where it shelved off. Behind the trees, he could hear the fall of the river. The trail was gone, and just before he started down the bank to the river, he stepped into a snowdrift up over his knees and panicked, clawing up handfuls of snow and vines to get out. The river looked impossibly cold, silver green with ice on the little pools in the rocks along the edge. Before, he'd caught his fish a lot farther downriver, but then it was different, and now the rocks were sharp and slippery to walk on. Here the water was fast and broken, and he walked down a little to where it smoothed out. The water ran slower and was deeper here, and maybe he just might pick up something if he were lucky. There was a stiff yellow beach 30 yards across on the other side, but there was no way of getting over. He lifted up onto a frost-covered black log and looked around. The big trees all around him and the high, cloud-cowled white mountains. Pretty as a picture, the way the steam lay over the river. It made him feel like he didn't even want to smoke, and he sat there on the log, swinging his legs back and forth while he threaded the line through his guides. He tied on one of the outfits he'd made up last night. When everything was ready, he slipped down off the log. He pulled the new rubber boots up over his legs as high as they would go and fastened the buckle tops of the waders to his belt. Slowly, he waded into the river, holding his breath for the cold water shock. The water hit and, swirling, embraced his legs, sucking his boots tight. He stopped, then edged out a little farther. He took the brake off his reel and made a nice cast upstream. By the time he'd fished out the hole, staying longer than he ever would have before without a strike, he began to feel some of the old excitement coming back. In a few minutes, he came out of the water and sat down on a rock with his back against a log. The water drops glistened on his boots. He took out the cookies. He wasn't going to hurry. Not today. Some tiny birds came from somewhere and perched on the rocks beside the water. They began bobbing back and forth, tipping their beaks down toward the water but not quite touching it, then straightening up with a nervous flutter and beginning over. It must be some kind of game, he thought after a while. He almost felt sorry for them, tipping back and forth, over and over, but never quite touching the water. They flew when he scattered a handful of crumbs toward them.
The tops of the trees creaked and the wind was drawing the clouds up out of the valleys and over the hills. The silver sound of the never-ending river run. Then he heard a spatter of shots somewhere across the river, but they came too fast for him to count. He'd just changed flies and made the first cast when he saw the deer. It stumbled out of the brush upriver and onto the little beach, nodding and twisting its head, streaming long ropes of white mucus. Its left hind leg was broken and dragged behind, and for an instant the deer stopped and turned her head back to look at it. Then into the water, slipping and almost falling, out into the current until only her back and head were showing. She reached the shallow water on his side and came out clumsily, twisting her head and shaking. He stood very still and watched her go into the trees. Dirty bastards. He had a kind of bad taste in his stomach. He tried to make another cast, then reeled in and went back to the shore. He sat down and ate the sandwich slowly. It was dry and didn't have any taste to it, but he ate it anyway, and tried not to think about the deer. Francis would be up now, doing things around the house, but he didn't want to think about Francis either. He remembered that morning when he caught the three steelhead, and it was all he could do to carry them up the hill in the gunny sack. But he did, and poured them out on the steps in front of the cabin. She'd whistled, touching her finger on the black spots along their backs, and he'd gone back that afternoon and caught two more. Now it was colder and the wind was down from the trees, blowing across the river. He got up stiffly and hobbled around over the rocks trying to loosen up. He thought about building a fire, but then decided he wouldn't stay much longer. Some crows flapped by overhead, coming from across the river. When they were over him, he yelled, but they didn't even look down. They weren't like hawks, and he hated their black, awkward flight. He changed flies again, added more weight, and cast upstream. He let the current take the line through his fingers until he saw the slack belly out on the water. He set the brake. The pencil lead weight bouncing against the rocks under the water and the gentle throb under his hand running down to the butt of the rod stuck against his stomach. He wondered how the fly looked down there, if it were light enough for a fish to see. The boys came out of the trees and onto the beach upriver, shifting around, looking at him and then looking up and down the river. Some of them got down on their hands and knees and looked for tracks, and then looked up at him again. When they began coming down the beach toward him, he looked up at the hills, and then down the river where the best water was, and where he should have gone. He turned a little in the water until he was facing downriver and began to reel in, catching his fly and setting the hook into the cork above the reel. Then he started easing sideways back toward the shore, thinking only of the shore and that each careful step brought him one step closer.
Hey.
He turned slowly around, wishing it could have been when he was on the shore, not here with the water pushing against his legs, off balance on the slippery rocks. His feet moved almost instinctively, wedging themselves into cracks or down between rocks while his eyes picked out the leader. All of them wore what looked like holsters or knife sheaths on their sides. Only the one boy had a rifle, gaunt and thin-faced, wearing a brown duck-billed cap, he said.
You see a deer come up there?
He held up the gun in his right hand like a pistol, pointing the barrel up the beach. One of the boys said,
Sure he did, Jewel. It ain't been very long.
And looked around at the four others. They nodded, passing round a cigarette, watching him.
I said, You see him?
It wasn't a him, it was a her. Harold said, and her back leg was almost shot off for Christ's sake.
Was that to you?
The one with the gun said.
He's pretty smart, ain't he, Jewel? Tell us where it went, you son of a bitch.
Where'd he go?
The boy asked, and raised the gun to his hip, half pointing it across at Harold.
Who wants to know?
Harold dropped the cigarette, and it gave a little spurt sound as it hit the water. He held the rod straight ahead, tied up under his arm and with his other hand pulled down his hat.
You little bastards are from that trailer camp downriver, aren't you?
You think you know a lot, don't you?
The boy said, looking around at the others, nodding at them, raising up one foot and setting it down slowly, then the other, like some terrible pantomime of chill or anger. Then the boy raised the rifle to his shoulder and pulled back the hammer. The barrel pointed somewhere at his stomach, or lower down, maybe, his groin or his balls. He felt them contract. The water swirled and foamed around his boots and made a little trail of white before smoothing out. He swayed, working his mouth at the phlegm pulling in his dry throat, but not able to move his tongue, looking down into the clear water at the rocks and the little spaces of sand. He wondered what it would be if his boots tipped water and he went down, rolling like a chunk.
"What's the matter with you?" he asked.
The ice water came up through his legs then, poured into his chest. The boy didn't say anything, just stood there. All of them just stood there looking at him.
"Don't shoot," he said.
The boy held the gun on him for another minute, then lowered it.
"Scared, wasn't you?"
Harold nodded his head dreamily. He kept feeling like he wanted to yawn, opening and closing his mouth. One of them pried loose a rock from the edge of the water and threw it. Harold turned his back and it hit a little behind and below him. The others began throwing and he stood there looking at the shore, hearing the rocks splash around him.
"You didn't want to fish here anyway, did you? I could have got you, but I didn't. Now you see that deer, remember how lucky you was. Here."
One of the boys made an obscene gesture with his hand, and the rest of them grinned. Then they moved in a pack back into the trees. He watched them go, then turned and worked his way back to the shore and dropped down against a log. After a few minutes, he got up and started to walk back to the cabin. The snow had held back all day, and now, as he was in sight of the clearing, the light, sticky flakes began falling. Somewhere he'd lost his rod. Maybe when he stopped that one time, he couldn't remember laying it on the snow. Anyway, it didn't matter. It was a good rod, one that he'd paid over $40 for one summer 5 or 6 years ago. But even if it were nice tomorrow, he wouldn't go back for it. But what was tomorrow? He had to be back tomorrow. A jay cried up in a tree over him, and another answered across the clearing up by his cabin. He was tired and walked slowly. Each step, a conscious raising of one leg and then setting it down again in front of the other. He came out of the trees and stopped. Down below at the lodge, they'd turned on the lights, although it wasn't dark. Somehow he had missed it, and it was gone. Something heroic. He didn't know what he was going to do. He couldn't very well go home. Slow, thick flakes sifted down through the freezing air, sticking on his coat collar, melting cold and wet against his face. He stared at the wordless, distorted things around him. Furious seasons. That duration which maketh pyramids, pillars of snow, and all that's past a moment. Sir Thomas Browne. Rain threatens. Already the tops of the hills across the valley are obscured by the heavy gray mist. Quick-shifting black clouds with white furrows and caps are coming from the hills, moving down the valley and passing over the fields and vacant lots in front of the apartment house. If Farrell lets go his imagination, he can see the clouds as black horses with flared white manes and, turning behind, slowly, inexorably, black chariots, here and there a white-plumed driver. He shuts the screen door now and watches his wife step slowly down the stairs. She turns at the bottom and smiles, and he opens the screen and waves. In another moment, she drives off.
He goes back into the room and sits down in the big leather chair under the brass lamp, laying his arms straight out along the sides of the chair. It is a little darker in the room when Iris comes out of her bath, wrapped in a loose white dressing gown. She pulls the stool out from under the dresser and sits down in front of the mirror. With her right hand, she takes up a white plastic brush, the handle inset with imitation pearl, and begins combing out her hair in long, sweeping, rhythmical movements, the brush passing down through the length of the hair with a faint squeaking noise. She holds her hair down over the one shoulder with her left hand and makes the long, sweeping, rhythmical movements with the right. She stops once and switches on the lamp over the mirror. Farrell takes up a glossy picture magazine from the stand beside the chair and reaches up to turn on the lamp, fumbling against the parchment-like shade in his hunt for the chain. The lamp is 2 feet over his right shoulder, and the brown shade crackles as he touches it. It is dark outside, and the air smells of rain. Iris asks if he will close the window. He looks up at the window, now a mirror, seeing himself, and behind, Iris sitting at the dresser watching him with another, darker Farrell staring into another window beside her. He has yet to call Frank and confirm the hunting trip for the next morning. He turns the pages. Iris takes down the brush from her hair and taps it on the dresser edge.
"Lou," she says, "you know I'm pregnant?"
Under the lamplight, the glossy pages are open now to a half-tone, two-page picture of a disaster scene, an earthquake somewhere in the Near East. There are 5 almost fat men dressed in white baggy pants, standing in front of a flattened house. One of the men, probably the leader, is wearing a dirty white hat that hangs down over one eye, giving him a secret, malevolent look. He is looking sideways at the camera, pointing across the mess of blocks to a river or a neck of the sea on the far side of the rubble. Farrell closes the magazine and lets it slide out of his lap as he stands. He turns out the light and then, before going on through to the bathroom, asks,
"What are you going to do?"
The words are dry, hurrying like old leaves into the dark corners of the room, and Farrell feels at the same instant the words are out that the question has already been asked by someone else, a long time ago. He turns and goes into the bathroom. It smells of iris, a warm, moist odor, slightly sticky. New spring talc and King's Idol cologne. Her towel lies across the back of the toilet. In the sink, she has spilled talcum. It is wet now and pasty and makes a thick yellow ring around the white sides. He rubs it out and washes it into the drain. He is shaving. By turning his head, he can see into the living room. Iris in profile, sitting on the stool in front of the old dresser. He lays down the razor and washes his face, then picks up the razor again. At this moment, he hears the first few drops of rain spatter against the roof. After a while, he turns out the light over the dresser and sits down again in the big leather chair, listening to the rain. The rain comes in short, fluttery swishes against his window, the soft fluttering of a white bird. His sister has caught it. She keeps it in a box, dropping in flowers for it through the top, sometimes shaking the box so they can hear it fluttering its wings against the sides until one morning she shows him, holding out the box, there is no fluttering inside. Only a lumpy, scraping sound the bird makes as she tilts the box from one side to the other. When she gives it to him to get rid of, he throws the box and all into the river, not wanting to open it, for it has started to smell funny. The cardboard box is 18 inches long and 6 inches wide and 4 inches deep, and he is sure it is a snowflake cracker box because this is what she used for the first few birds. He runs along the squashy bank following. It is a funeral boat, and the muddy river is the Nile, and it will soon run into the ocean. But before that, the boat will burn up, and the white bird will fly out and into his father's field someplace,
where he will hunt out the bird in some thick growth of green meadow grass, eggs and all. He runs along the bank, the brush whipping his pants, and once a limb hits him on the ear, and it still hasn't burned. He pulls loose some rocks from the bank and begins throwing them at the boat, and then the rain begins. Huge, gusty, spattering drops that belt the water, sweeping across the river from one shore to the other. Farrell had been in bed for a number of hours now, how long he could not be sure. Every so often he raised up on one shoulder, careful not to disturb his wife, and peered across to her nightstand, trying for a look at the clock. Its side was turned a little too much in his direction, and raising as he does on one shoulder, being as careful as possible, he could see only that the yellow hands say 3:15 or 2:45. Outside, the rain came against his window. He turned on his back, his legs spread wide under the sheet, barely touching his wife's left foot, listening to the clock on the nightstand. He pulled down into the quilts again, and then because it was too hot and his hands were sweating, he threw back the close covers, twisting his fingers into the sheet, crushing it between his fingers and knotting it against his palms until they felt dry. Outside, the rain came in clouds, lifting up in swells against the faint yellow outside light like myriads of tiny yellow insects coming furiously against his window, spitting and rippling. He turned over and slowly began working himself closer to Lorraine, until her smooth back touched his chest. For a moment he held her gently, carefully, his hand lying in the hollow of her stomach, his fingers slipped under the elastic band of her underpants, the fingertips barely touching the stiff, brush-like hair below. An odd sensation then, like slipping into a warm bath and feeling himself a child again, the memories flooding back. He moved his hand and pulled away, then eased out of bed and walked to the streaming window. It was a huge, foreign dream night outside. The street lamp, a gaunt, scarred obelisk, running up into the rain with a faint yellow light holding to its point. At its base, the street was black, shiny. Darkness swirled and pulled at the edges of the light. He could not see the other apartments, and for a moment, it was as if they'd been destroyed, like the houses in the picture he'd been looking at a few hours ago. The rain appeared and disappeared against the window like a dark veil opened and closed. Down below, it flooded at the curbs. Leaning closer until he could feel the cold drafts of air on his forehead from the bottom of the window, he watched his breath make a fog. He had read someplace, and it seemed he could remember looking at some picture once, perhaps National Geographic, where groups of brown-skinned people stood around their huts watching the frosted sun come up. The caption said they believed the soul was visible in the breath, that they were spitting and blowing into the palms of their hands, offering their souls to God. His breath disappeared while he watched until only a tiny circle, a dot, remained. Then nothing. He turned away from the window for his things. He fumbled in the closet for his insulated boots, his hands tracing the sleeves of each coat until he found the rubber-slick waterproof. He went to the drawer for socks and long underwear, then picked up his shirt and pants and carried the armload through the hallway into the kitchen before turning on the light. He dressed and pulled on his boots before starting the coffee. He would have liked to turn on the porch light for Frank, but somehow it didn't seem good with Iris out there in bed. While the coffee perked, he made sandwiches, and when it had finished, he filled a thermos, took a cup down from the cupboard, filled it, and sat down near the window where he could watch the street. He smoked and drank the coffee and listened to the clock on the stove, squeaking. The coffee slopped over the cup and the brown drops ran slowly down the side onto the table. He rubbed his fingers through the wet circle across the rough tabletop. He is sitting at the desk in his sister's room. He sits in the straight-backed chair on a thick dictionary, his feet curled up beneath the seat of the chair, the heels of his shoes hooked on the rung. When he leans too heavily on the table, one of the legs picks up from the floor, so he has to put a magazine under the leg. He is drawing a picture of the valley he lives in. At first, he meant to trace a picture from one of his sister's school books, but after using 3 sheets of paper and having it still not turn out right, he has decided to draw his valley and his house. Occasionally, he stops drawing and rubs his fingers across the grainy surface of the table. Outside, the April air is still damp and cool, the coolness that comes after the rain in the afternoon. The ground and the trees and the mountains are green, and steam is everywhere, coming off the troughs in the corral, from the pond his father made and out of the meadow in slow, pencil-like columns, rising off the river and going up over the mountains like smoke. He can hear his father shouting to one of the men, and he hears the man swear and shout back. He puts his drawing pencil down and slips off the chair. Down below, in front of the smokehouse, he sees his father working with the pulley. At his feet, there is a coil of brown rope, and his father is hitting and pulling on the pulley bar, trying to swing it out and away from the barn. On his head, he wears a brown wool army cap, and the collar of his scarred leather jacket is turned up, exposing the dirty white lining. With a final blow at the pulley, he turns around facing the men. Two of them, big, red-faced Canadians with greasy flannel hats, dragging the sheep toward his father. Their fists are balled deep into the wool, and one of them has his arms wrapped around the front legs of the sheep. They go toward the barn, half-dragging, half-walking the sheep on its hind legs, like some wild dance. His father calls out again, and they pin the sheep against the barn wall, one of the men straddling the sheep, forcing its head back and up toward his window. Its nostrils are dark slits with little streams of mucus running down into its mouth. The ancient glazed eyes stare up at him for a moment before it tries to bleat, but the sound comes out a sharp squeaking noise as his father cuts it off with a quick sweeping thrust of the knife. The blood gushes out over the man's hands before he can move. In a few moments, they have the animal up on the pulley. He can hear the dull crank, crank, crank of the pulley as his father winds it even higher. The men are sweating now, but they keep their jackets fastened up tight. Starting right below the gaping throat, his father opens up the brisket and belly while the men take the smaller knives and begin cutting the pelt away from the legs. The gray guts slide out of the steaming belly and tumble onto the ground in a thick coil. His father grunts and scoops them into a box, saying something about bear. The red-faced men laugh. He hears the chain in the bathroom rattle and then the water gurgling into the toilet. A moment later, he turns toward the door as footsteps approach. His sister comes into the room, her body faintly steaming. For an instant, she is frozen there in the doorway with the towel around her hair, one hand holding the ends together and the other on the doorknob. Her breasts are round and smooth-looking, the nipples like the stems of the warm porcelain fruit on the living room table. She drops the towel and it slides down, pulling at her neck, touching across her breasts, and then heaping up at her feet. She smiles, slowly puts the hand to her mouth and pulls the door shut. He turns back to the window, his toes curling up in his shoes. Farrell sat at the table, sipping his coffee, smoking again on an empty stomach. Once he heard a car in the street and got up quickly out of the chair, walking to the porch window to see. It started up the street in second, then slowed in front of his house, taking the corner carefully, water churning half up to its hubs, but it went on. He sat down at the table again and listened to the electric clock on the stove, squeaking. His fingers tightened around the cup. Then he saw the lights. They came bobbing down the street out of the darkness. 2 close-set signal lanterns on a narrow prow, the heavy white rain falling across the lights, pelting the street ahead. It splashed down the street, slowed, then eased in under his window. He picked up his things and went out on the porch. Iris was there, stretched out under the twisted pile of heavy quilts. Even as he hunted for a reason for the action,
as if he were detached somehow, crouched on the other side of her bed, watching himself go through this, at the same time knowing it was over, he moved toward her bed. Irresistibly, he bent down over her figure, as if he hung suspended, all senses released except that of smell. He breathed deeply for the fleeting scent of her body. Bending until his face was against her covers, he experienced the scent again for just an instant, and then it was gone. He backed away, remembered his gun, then pulled the door shut behind him. The rain whipped into his face. He felt almost giddy, clutching his gun and holding on to the banister, steadying himself. For a minute, looking down over the porch to the black, ripply sidewalk, it was as though he were standing alone on a bridge someplace, and again the feeling came, as it had last night, that this had already happened, knowing then that it would happen again, just as he somehow knew now. Christ. The rain cut at his face, ran down his nose and onto his lips. Frank tapped the horn twice, and Farrell went carefully down the wet, slippery stairs to the car.
"Regular downpour, by God," Frank said. A big man with a thick, quilted jacket zipped up to his chin and a brown duckbill cap that made him look like a grim umpire. He helped move things around in the back seat so Farrell could put his things in. Water ran up against the gutters, backed up at the drains on the corners, and now and then they could see where it had flooded over the curbs and into a yard. They followed the street to its end, and then turned right onto another street that would take them to the highway.
"This is going to slow us down some, but Jesus, think what it's going to do to them geese."
Once again, Farrell let go and saw them, pulling back from that one moment when even the fog had frozen to the rocks, and so dark it could as well have been midnight as late afternoon when they started. They come over the bluff, flying low and savage and silent, coming out of the fog suddenly, spectrally, in a swishing of wings over his head, and he is jumping up trying to single out the closest, at the same moment pushing forward his safety, but it is jammed and his stiff gloved finger stays hooked into the guard, pulling against the locked trigger. They all come over him, flying out of the fog across the bluff and over his head, great strings of them calling down to him. This was the way it happened 3 years ago. He watched the wet fields fall under their lights, and then sweep beside and then behind the car. The windshield wipers squeaked back and forth. Iris pulls her hair down over the one shoulder with her left hand while the other wields the brush. Rhythmically, the brush makes its sweeping movement through the length of the hair with a faint squeaking noise. The brush rises quickly again to the side of the head and repeats the movement and the sound. She has just told him she is pregnant. Lorraine has gone to a shower. He has still to call Frank and confirm the hunting trip. The glossy picture of the magazine he holds in his lap is open to the scene of a disaster. One of the men in the picture, evidently the leader, is pointing over the disaster scene to a body of water.
"What are you going to do?"
He turns and goes on through to the bathroom. Her towel hangs over the back of the toilet, and the bathroom smells of new spring talc and King's Idol cologne. There is a yellow pasty ring of talcum powder in the sink that he must rub out with water before he shaves. He can look through to the living room where she sits combing her hair. When he has washed his face and dried, just after he has picked up the razor again, the first raindrops strike the roof. He looked at the clock on the dashboard, but it had stopped.
"What time is it?"
"Don't pay any attention to that clock there," Frank said, lifting his thumb off the wheel to indicate the big glowing yellow clock protruding from the dash. "It stopped. It's 6:30. Did your wife say you had to be home at a certain time?" He smiled. Farrell shook his head, but Frank would not be able to see this.
"No, just wondered what time it was."
He lit a cigarette and slumped back in his seat, watching the rain sweep into the car lights and splash against the window. They are driving down from Yakima to get Iris.
It started to rain when they hit the Columbia River Highway, and by the time they got through Arlington, it was a torrent. It is like a long, sloping tunnel, and they are speeding down the black road with the thick, matted trees close overhead and the water cascading against the front of the car. Lorraine's arm extends along the back of the seat, her hand resting lightly on his left shoulder. She is sitting so close that he can feel her left breast rise and fall with her breathing. She has just tried to dial something on the radio, but there is too much static.
She can fix up the porch for a place to sleep and keep her things, Farrell says, not taking his eyes off the road. It won't be for long.
Lorraine turns toward him for a moment, leaning forward a little in the seat, placing her free hand on his thigh. With her left hand, she squeezes her fingers into his shoulder, then leans her head against him. After a while, she says,
"You're all mine, Lou. I hate to think of sharing you for even a little while with anybody, even your own sister."
The rain lets up gradually, and often there are no trees at all over their heads. Once Farrell sees the moon, a sharp, stark yellow crescent shining through the mist of gray clouds, they leave the woods and the curved roads and they follow it into a valley that opens onto the river below. It has stopped raining, and the sky is a black rug with handfuls of glistening stars strewn about.
"How long will she stay?"
Lorraine asks.
"A couple of months. 3 at the most. The Seattle job will be open for her before Christmas."
The ride has made his stomach a little fluttery. He lights a cigarette. The gray smoke streams out of his nose and is immediately pulled out through the wing window. The cigarette began to bite the tip of his tongue, and he cracked the window and dropped it out. Frank turned off the highway and onto a slick backdrop that would take them to the river. They were in the wheat country now, the great fields of harvested wheat rolling out toward the dimly outlined hills beyond, and broken every so often by a muddy, churned-looking field, glimmering with little pockets of water. Next year they would be in plant, and in the summer the wheat would stand as high as a man's waist, hissing and bending when the wind blew.
"It's a shame," Frank said. "All this land without grain half the time, with half the people in the world starving."
He shook his head. "If the government would keep its fingers off the farm, we'd be a damn sight better off." The pavement ended in a jag of cracks and chuck holes, and the car bounced onto the rubbery, black-pitted road that stretched like a long black avenue toward the hills.
"Have you ever seen them when they harvest, Lou?"
"No."
The morning grayed. Farrell saw the stubble fields turned into a cheat yellow as he watched. He looked out the window at the sky where gray clouds rolled and broke into massive, clumsy chunks.
"The rain's going to quit."
They came to the foot of the hills where the fields ended, then turned and drove along at the edge of the fields, following the hills until they came to the head of the canyon. Far below, at the very bottom of the stone-ribbed canyon, lay the river, its far side covered by a bank of fog.
"It's stopped raining," Farrell said.
Frank backed the car into a small rocky ravine and said it was a good enough place. Farrell took out his shotgun and leaned it against the rear fender before taking out his shell bag and extra coat. Then he lifted out the paper sack with the sandwiches, and his hand closed tightly around the warm, hard thermos. They walked away from the car without talking and along the ridge before starting to drop down into one of the small valleys that opened into the canyon. The earth was studded here and there with sharp rocks or a black, dripping bush. The ground sogged under his feet, pulled at his boots with every step, and made a sucking noise when he released them. He carried the shell bag in his right hand, swinging it like a sling, letting it hang down by its strap from his hand. A wet breeze off the river blew against his face. The sides of the low bluffs overlooking the river down below were deeply grooved and cut back into the rock, leaving table-like projections jutting out, marking the high water lines for thousands of years past. Piles of naked white logs and countless pieces of driftwood lay jammed onto the ledge like cairns of bones dragged up onto the cliffs by some giant bird. Farrell tried to remember where the geese came over 3 years ago. He stopped on the side of a hill, just where it sloped into the canyon, and leaned his gun on a rock. He pulled bushes and gathered rocks from nearby and walked down toward the river after some of the driftwood to make a blind. He sat on his raincoat with his back against a hard shrub, his knees drawn up to his chin, watching the sky whiten and then blue a little and the clouds run with the wind. Geese were gabbling somewhere in the fog on the other side of the river. He rested and smoked and watched the smoke whip out of his mouth. He waited for the sun. It is 4 in the afternoon. The sun has just gone behind the gray, late afternoon clouds, leaving a dwarfed half-shadow that falls across the car following him as he walks around to open the door for his wife. They kiss. Iris and he will be back for her in 1 hour and 45 minutes exactly. They are going by the hardware store and then to the grocery. They will be back for her at 5:45. He slides in behind the wheel again and in a moment, seeing his chance, eases out into the traffic. On the way out of town, he must stop and wait for every red light, finally turning left onto the secondary, hitting the gas so hard that they both lean back a little in the seat. It is 4:20. At the forks, they turn onto the blacktop, orchards on both sides of the road. Over the tops of the trees, the low brown hills and beyond, the blue-black mountains crowned with white. From the close row of trees, shadows blackening into the shoulders creep across the pavement in front of the car. New boxes are jumbled together in white piles at the end of each orchard row, and up against the trees or pushed into the limbs, some leaning in the crotches, are the ladders. He slows the car and stops, pulling off onto the shoulder close enough to one of the trees so that all Iris has to do is open her door and she can reach the limb. It scrapes against the door as she releases it. The apples are heavy and yellow, and sweet juice spurts into his teeth as he bites into one. The road ends, and they follow the dust-covered hard track right up to the edge of the hills where the orchards stop. He can still go farther, though, by turning onto the bank road that follows the irrigation canal. The canal is empty now, and the steep dirt banks are dry and crumbling. He has shifted the car into second. The road is steeper, driving is more difficult and slower. He stops the car under a pine tree outside a water gate, where the canal comes down out of the hills to slide into a circular cement trough. Iris lays her head in his lap. It is nearly dark. The wind is blowing through the car, and once he hears the tops of the trees creaking. He gets out of the car to light a cigarette, walking to the rim of the hill overlooking the valley. The wind has strengthened. The air is colder. The grass is sparse under his feet, and there are a few flowers. The cigarette makes a short, twisting red arc as it spins down into the valley. It is 6 o'clock. The cold was bad. The dead numbness of the toes, the cold slowly working its way up into the calves of his legs and setting in under his knees. His fingers, too, stiff and cold, even though they were balled into his pockets. Farrell waited for the sun. The huge clouds over the river turned, breaking up, shaping and reshaping while he watched. At first, he barely noticed the black line against the lowest clouds. When it crossed into sight, he thought it was mosquitoes, close up against his blind, and then it was a far-off, dark rent between cloud and sky that moved closer while he watched. The line turned toward him then and spread out over the hills below. He was excited but calm, his heart beating in his ears, urging him to run, yet his movements slow and ponderous, as if heavy stones hung to his legs. He inched up on his knees until his face pressed into the brush wall and turned his eyes toward the ground. His legs shook and he pushed his knees into the soft earth. The legs grew suddenly numb and he moved his hand and pushed it into the ground up over his fingers, surprised at its warmth. Then the soft gabble of geese over his head and the heavy whistling push of wings. His finger tightened around the trigger, the quick rasping calls, the sharp upward jerk of 10 feet as they saw him. Farrell was on his feet now, pulling down on one goose before swinging to another, then again quickly onto a closer one, following it as it broke and cut back over his head toward the river. He fired once, twice, and the geese kept flying, clamoring, split up and out of range, their low forms melting into the rolling hills. He fired once more before dropping back to his knees inside the blind. Somewhere on the hill behind him, and a little to the left, he heard Frank shooting, the reports rolling down through the canyon like sharp whip snaps. He felt confused to see more geese getting off the river, stringing out over the low hills and rising up the canyon, flying in V formations for the top of the canyon and the fields behind. He reloaded carefully, pushing the green ribbed number twos up into the breech, pumping one of the shells into the chamber with a hollow cracking sound. Yet 6 shells would do the job better than 3. He quickly loosened the plug from the underbarrel of the gun and dropped the coil spring and the wooden plug into his pocket. He heard Frank shoot again, and suddenly there was a flock gone by he hadn't seen. As he watched them, he saw 3 more coming in low from the side. He waited until they were even with him, swinging across the side of the hill 30 yards away, their heads swinging slowly, rhythmically, right to left, the eyes black and glistening. He raised to one knee just as they passed him, giving him a good lead, squeezing off an instant before they flared. The one nearest him crumpled and dived straight into the ground. He fired again as they turned, seeing the goose stop as if it had run into a wall, flailing against the wall trying to get over it before turning over, head downward, wings out, to slowly spiral down. He emptied his gun at the 3rd goose, even when it was probably out of range, seeing it stop the charge on the 5th shot, its tail jerking hard and settling down, but its wings still beating. For a long time he watched it flying closer and closer to the ground before it disappeared into one of the canyons. Farrell laid the 2 geese on their backs inside the blind and stoked their smooth white undersides. They were Canadian geese, honkers. After this, it didn't matter too much that the geese that flew came over too high or went out someplace else down the river. He sat against the shrub and smoked, watching the sky whirl by over his head. Sometime later, perhaps in the early afternoon, he slept. When he woke, he was stiff, cold and sweating, and the sun was gone, the sky a thickening gray pall. Somewhere he could hear geese calling and going out, leaving those strange, sharp echoes in the valleys. But he could see nothing but wet, black hills that ended in fog where the river should have been. He wiped his hand over his face and began to shiver. He stood up. He could see the fog rolling up the canyon and over the hills, closing off and hemming in the land, and he felt the breath of the cold, damp air around him, touching his forehead and cheeks and lips. He broke through the blind, getting out and starting running up the hill. He stood outside the car and pressed the horn in a continual blast until Frank ran up and jerked his arm away from the window. "What's the matter with you? Are you crazy or something?"
"I have to go home, I tell you."
"Jesus Christ. Well, Jesus Christ, get in then, get in." They were quiet then, but for Farrell's asking twice the time before they were out of the wheat country. Frank held a cigar between his teeth, never taking his eyes from the road. When they ran into the first drifting patches of fog, he switched on the car lights. After they turned onto the highway, the fog lifted and layered somewhere in the dark over the car, and the first drops of rain began hitting the windshield. Once 3 ducks flew in front of the car lights and pitched into a puddle beside the road. Farrell blinked.
"Did you see that?" Frank asked.
Farrell nodded.
"How do you feel now?"
"Okay."
"You get any geese?"
Farrell rubbed the palms of his hands together, interlacing his fingers, finally folding them into his lap.
"No, I guess not."
"Too bad. I heard you shooting."
He worked the cigar to the other side of his mouth and tried to puff, but it had gone cold. He chewed on it for a minute, then laid it in the ashtray and glanced at Farrell.
"Of course, it's none of my affair, but if it's something you're worried about at home, my advice is not to take it too seriously. You'll live longer. No gray hairs like me. He coughed, laughed. I know, I used to be the same way. I remember.
Farrell is sitting in the big leather chair under the brass lamp watching Iris comb out her hair. He is holding a magazine in his lap whose glossy pages are open to the scene of a disaster, an earthquake somewhere in the Near East. Except for the small light over the dresser, it is dark in the room. The brush moves quickly through her hair in long, sweeping, rhythmical movements, causing a faint squeaking noise in the room. He has yet to call Frank and confirm the hunting trip for the next morning. There is a cold, moist air coming in through the window from the outside. She is tapping the brush against the edge of the dresser.
Lou, she says, you know I'm pregnant?
Her bathroom smell sickens him. Her towel lies across the back of the toilet. In the sink, she has spilled talcum. It is wet now and pasty and makes a thick yellow ring around the white sides. He rubs it out and washes it into the drain. He is shaving. By turning his head, he can see into the living room. Iris in profile sitting on the stool in front of the old dresser. She is combing her hair. She lays down the razor and washes his face, then picks up the razor again. At this moment, he hears the first few drops of rain spatter against the roof. He carries her out to the porch, turns her face to the wall, and covers her up. He goes back into the bathroom, washes his hands, and stuffs the heavy, blood-soaked towel into the clothes hamper. After a while, he turns out the light over the dresser and sits down again in his chair by the window, listening to the rain. Frank laughed.
So it was nothing. Nothing at all. We got along fine after that. Oh, the usual bickering now and then, but when she found out just who was running the show, everything was all right.
He gave Farrell a friendly rap on the knee. They drove into the outskirts of town, past the long line of motels with their blazing red, blinking neon lights, past the cafes with steamy windows and cars clustered in front, and past the small businesses, dark and locked until the next day. Frank turned right at the next light, then left, and now they were on Farrell Street. Frank pulled in behind a black and white car that had Sheriff's Office painted in small white letters across the trunk. In the lights of their car, they could see another glass inside the car, inset with a wire screen, making the back seat into a cage. Steam rose from the hood of their car and mixed with the rain.
Could be he's after you, Lou. He started to open the door, then chuckled. Maybe they've found out you were hunting with no license. Come on, I'll turn you in myself.
No, you go on, Frank. That's all right, I'll be all right. Wait a minute, let me get out.
Christ, you'd really think they were after you. Wait a minute, get your gun.
He rolled down the window and passed out the shotgun to Farrell.
Looks like the rain's never going to let up. See you.
Yeah.
Upstairs, all the lights of his apartment were turned on, and blurred figures stood freeze-like at the windows looking down through the rain. Farrell stood behind the sheriff's car, holding on to the smooth, wet tail fin. Rain fell on his bare head and worked its way down under his collar. Frank drove a few yards up the street and stopped, looking back. Farrell holding on to the tail fin, swaying a little, with the fine, impenetrable rain coming down around him. The gutter water rushed over his feet, swirled frothing into a great whirlpool at the drain on the corner, and rushed down to the center of the earth.